This episode of Forensic Forecast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at www.digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by contributions by our listeners. Thank you all very much. Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast. I am Lord Voldemort, and my Death Eaters today are Eric Huber. How are you doing, Eric?
Hi, Lee. Good to be back.
Also joining us is Ryan Pittman. How are you doing, Ryan?
Finally, thanks.
Good, good. And also the giant persistent friend, Rob Lee. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm confused. I thought I was supposed to be the house elf, not a death eater. We talked about this.
You're far too large to be a house elf.
not the giant house elves. I come from that clan. This is upsetting.
Cool. All right. Well, apologies for it's taken so long to come back. As you know, we tried you may not know, we tried a couple of video episodes of Forensic Forecast. First one went pretty well with Jesse Kornblum. The second one, not so well. had a few technical hitches with that. But I, for one, am quite pleased that we're back doing the audio ones. We're going to try and do them once a month. And the reason I'm pleased is because I can go back to doing Forensic Forecast in my underwear. So
we're glad of that as well.
No, I jest. Honestly, I jest. That was especially for Luby just to give him that visual. He deserves it. So, yeah, it's been a busy few months, and a lot's been happening. And I think we'll just jump straight in. And apparently, the UK sees terrorism and cyber attacks as the major threats facing the UK in the future. Now, I don't know if it's just the UK that feel this way. I'm pretty sure that other countries must be bordering on saying similar things. But why? I mean, obviously, there's the whole hacking into computer systems and whatnot, but what's the real threat of cyber attacks? I mean, you guys tell me.
Rob, do you want to start off?
What is it? I could kind of tell everyone's looking at me, even though I can't see them.
Mr. Sands guy, man.
It's such a complex question, and so it's something that comes up all the time. You know, even a wider question is, you know, are we currently in cyber war? And it comes back to, you know, and this is something I like to throw at you guys, you know, what do you define a cyber war as? You know, why would a country, you know, potentially put this as a number one threat that's out there? And, you know, you have to go back to kind of the way we define warfare and overall our stance on it, you know, not, you know, from a pro or a negative stance, but again, from our, what do we actually think a cyber war would actually entail? And I think there's a tendency based off of what we see in the movies, starting with 1984, you know, with the War Games, when that movie came up, all the way through today, that a cyber attack is going to result in some sort of, you know, death, destruction, mayhem. You know, you're going to see, you know, power plants blow up, you know, the entire East Coast of the United States, you know, and Europe just blink out like you see in something like in one of those, you know, environmental movies that, you know, everything just, you know, goes to haywire at that point. There's that standpoint, but, you know, in reality, do we really believe that would happen if a full-scale cyber attack, you know, was underway? So, you know, that's one of the first questions I'd like to throw out there is, like, what do you guys define a cyber war as? From my perspective, I believe we're in cyber war right now, but I don't think that a cyber attack is going to be what we usually define as kinetic, but more after, you know, what is truly valuable economically today, which is knowing how your opponent thinks, being two steps ahead of them, and having more ability to generate, create better toys, more intellectual capital than your adversaries. And an adversary defined as, you know, a country that you're trying to compete with, not someone you truly hate. You know, so we're going to see potentially new avenues of cyber war potentially crop up in across even, you know, potentially friendly nations that are potentially competitive economically against each other.
Rob, you know, I think you hit the nail right on the head with that one, because I think, you know, as we're pushed into this mind frame, as I mean, all of us are kind of in have a unique understanding of our field, as do the other folks that are practitioners in the field. But the general public has only what is presented to them by the media, and the fact that cyber warfare and cyber terrorism is kind of this new frontier, this new thing that the general public is just now hearing about. And I think what's scary to them is the fact that computer technology in particular has integrated itself so closely in almost every aspect of our lives at almost all social stratum, where before, you know, you could say only the elite had the car phones and the mobile devices and the laptops. And now, you know, everybody's dogs practically have their own website. And I think it's kind of a verging on a mass panic situation, where if the general public really understood how close we came to really being in an open state of constant attack, they might be really worried. But I think you really hit it on the head where you said, I think the real form of cyber warfare that's going on right now is the stuff that's targeted at gaining that competitive advantage, whether it be from a governmental perspective, a defense perspective, an economic and enterprise perspective. I mean, that is the new holy grail. I mean, that is the new international currency. Information is power. We always talk about that and jokingly, you know, as kind of the movie Hackers and things like that have thrown it up 20 years ago. But I mean, that's really the thing. Howard Schmidt, the White House cybersecurity coordinator, hates the phrase cyber war. He doesn't like to apply that phrase to what's going on, because, you know, the wars are the things that are fought on land with tanks and sea with ships. And really what we have going on right now is more of a soft warfare, or this seeking the competitive advantage, whether it be in business or strategy.
Well, a great question. You know, one of the things that you're noticing there is that, you know, with what Howard Schmidt and others are doing, you know, when you actually define what warfare is, and, you know, like I think Jomini or Clausewitz, and going back to my military history here, said war is politics through other means. And when we start taking a look at it, why do countries go to war with each other? You know, I agree, you know, this is not going to be sit in the same definition there. But if you truly go back into why did two countries go to war with each other in, you know, all of history, they're either after land, produce more, you know, food for someone, that they're looking after the industrial resources to produce more goods. Or now what we, you know, Heidi and Alvin Toffler wrote a book called Third Wave that came out in the late 80s, actually, that was talking about that we're going to be now trading in intellectual capital much more than consumer goods, or even the country that is able to outproduce each other agriculturally. The countries that are able to outproduce each other intellectually in the future is going to be what is considered the prime, you know, the first leading country that's out there. And so attacking that ability, or being able to stay ahead of it, or acquiring that, like we used to acquire land, is where the definition is. And by that definition, you actually do not need to have kinetic warfare to be able to take over someone's home and sit in it and claim it as your own. All you just need to do is go in there and steal a copy of it. And as a result of that, you know, of course, no one will say that this is cyber war, because they're envisioning, you know, electrical grids powering up. But you really have to go back to what is the strategy, why warfare has been fought over the years. And, you know, as a result, I truly believe that, you know, what the UK and other countries are currently doing is understanding that and coming to a close agreement that if this is the case, you know, in the follow-on question, this is how do we potentially bring our militaries in to help defend, which is essentially civilian populace, against, you know, aggressors like this, adversaries like this. Currently, right now, there's no capability of any military DOD able to help defend a local bank or a Boeing or Lufthansa or Airbus from having all of their plans for the next generation aircraft stolen from them. So how would you potentially protect those? And again, there's so many legal issues that are out there that I just think that it's a step in the right direction to talk about it.
Well, here's two things that I absolutely love about this story. The first, it talks about the different tiers of threats in which the foreign secretary, Mr. Haig, placed these different things, talking about the national security strategy. And, of course, the computer attacks on UK cyberspace is placed in tier one. Now, in tier two, we have an attack on the UK using weapons of mass destruction. So what they're coming out and saying is that potentially a cyber attack directed against the UK is going to be more serious than the use of a weapon of mass destruction against the United Kingdom. I found that kind of fascinating. And then the second thing the foreign secretary goes on to say is that they need to increase their capability to protect themselves, not only against cyber attacks on the government, but also on businesses and on individuals. So I think echoing what you said there, focus not only on protecting the government, but also some of the less considered assets of national security, which are the folks that run the country and the folks that run the economy.
Is this possible to do, though? I mean, as a government, is it possible? I mean, I'll stand back and I say I have no idea specifically about this. But is it possible for a government to step in and say, right, we can control our cyberspace, so the companies behind, you know, our firewalls and everything will not get attacked or not get attacked as severely as others? As much as I'd like to believe that, I can't see a practical way of making that work.
China's done it.
What was that? I think basically you started to groan because I don't think you're actually allowed to say China. I think officially on this program, you're only allowed to say they who shall not be named.
Well, I mean, that's the purple elephant in the room. I mean, we talk about, I mean, obviously the UK and the US are not going to be willing to go the way of China and the totalitarian approach to controlling networks and security. But when we talk about, well, is it possible? Sure, it's possible. We look at a major power now that's absolutely done it. The question is, how far are we going to be willing to go in pursuit of that protection?
As a nation state out there too, I mean, when you start pulling in the potential intelligence gathering, military, I mean, law enforcement arms altogether, you could potentially predict, you know, or have wind of that a certain corporation will be potentially attacked. You could deploy resources on permission of the company to, you know, help them out, aid them, potential, you know, for free, to say, hey, listen, we'll give you additional personnel so you don't have to spend the money yourself. It could be through funding. I mean, basically, we're going to help, you know, fund your response to this and give you money to be able to do this. There's multiple ways for things to potentially, you know, play out. But as a result right now, you know, Lee's hit it on the head. It's very difficult to do. But again, if you think from a monitoring perspective, I think it'd be definitely difficult. But what about from an intel perspective that someone says, hey, we've gotten wind that Corporation Z, you're working on the flux capacitor, and we all know it, they know it, and they're going to come try and steal it from you. Well, we're going to let you know. We're going to give you some additional personnel and resources to potentially defend if you want it, if you ask us to. So there's potential, you know, ways here for us to potentially work with our governments in, you know, figuring out ways to potentially support our civilian industry.
See, the thing I think about this is that if I was a private company and I had something that I was sitting on, something big that I wanted to produce or, you know, or roll out, whatever, do I really want to share that information with anybody? You know, even if it's the government, because the more I share that information, so even if it is so they can protect me, the more difficult it is to control how that information is used. Does that make sense?
Well, sure. It depends on what your security is worth. I mean, it's the scale. I mean, you look at the arm on one side, laden with your need to protect your proprietary property, and on the other side, your need to call in somebody else to help you maintain that security. It's a balancing act that I don't think we're to a state yet where enterprise, particularly in the United States, has had to really make that choice. Government has been the enforcer of laws and regulations. They've been the purveyor of information, and still to this point, I think it's been a little short on openly offering assistance to that level to these different corporations.
What's going on right now that you have to remember is that most of these corporations are informed by the government that they're being intruded upon at this point. 80% or more are externally notified. As a result of that, most of these corporations turn back to the government and says, well, how can you help us? And usually the government's not able to, other than just a little bit of information, maybe some support, but the majority of the backbreaking work of trying to defend their own networks is being placed back on the corporations. Certain groups and entities out there have basically said, well, we tried to get rid of it. We didn't make it that far, but now we basically decided to live with it. In certain instances like that, the only thing is, like, I would at least like to see the option of saying it is legal to have groups do additional defense, not just investigation, but it's in, on behalf. Like, if a fire starts in that organization, you will have local firemen come in and help put it out. If a group from Venezuela comes up and lands in Miami and jumps off a boat and starts shooting people, as horrible as that sounds, you will have response from both police and potentially, in fact, the military, Coast Guard, to be able to defend as a result of that. But why all of a sudden does it change that when you have an aggressor, an adversary, also attacking civilian infrastructure, just because it switched from physical to cyber? Is there some mentality that needs to switch there that says there is no place for that to occur? Or is it there is a place, we just need to figure it out? And that's where I'm leaning right now, is that we need to get smart people, Eric, you, Lee, to be able to, think this through and saying what is the right measures to be able to bring governments in. And UK coming out and basically stating, what they're doing, this is our biggest threat in reality. For our survival long term, 100 years from now, as a nation state, that possibly is true. And it's fascinating when you think about it. But as we're becoming more wired and interconnected, is it going to be easier to do this without potentially resulting in death? And would it actually increase the ability for nations to potentially be conducting these wars without ever firing a shot? And that's basically what we're starting to see. What we're seeing right now with the one country is going to be replicated by others using that as an example, and it's only going to get worse. We're just now at the beginning of this, and we're going to see this for quite some time. Other countries pick up this thread and saying, hey, we could do that too. In fact, we could do it better.
See, is the right approach to this some sort of global alliance to take on something like this, or should we be relying on individual industrialized nations to do their own thing and kind of compare notes and say, oh, hey, I see what you did there. Maybe we should do that too. Or, hey, let us tell you what we've got going on to help make yours better. I mean, should there be a collective approach?
It exists right now. In fact, it's called the Order of the Phoenix.
Oh, gosh.
This is the Harry Potter theme show, right? I got my dragon intertwined wand ready to go. Dragon.
Oh, no.
I never claimed to be anything other than a muggle, so.
Hey, did we lose Eric, or he just fell asleep? Is this?
No, I'm like the third guy on NFL, in the booth in the ESPN. And this is all my sins of the past have come back to visit me today on this podcast, because usually I'm doing a lot of talking, and I always complain about NFL football, where it's like you don't need three idiots calling the game. So the third guy just needs to shut up. So I'm trying not to say anything just to say something, but I was tapping away, taking notes while Ryan and Rob were talking, and of course you guys just were talking so fast and making so many good points that you've overtaken anything I would have said. The only thing I would add is I think there's the cyber war issue. To me, I'm still amazed that this is a discussion. It's like, is there a cyber war going on? Well, clearly, the three of us fight it every day. So for us, it seems to be a pretty clear understanding. It's like, okay, fine. Just because a root click a root kit doesn't equal a mushroom cloud doesn't mean, you know, there isn't a cyber war. And what we've got going on is just this convergence of espionage and information warfare. You know, Intel's always been a key of warfare. And the cyber warfare, as you guys discussed, that's a key component. And it can definitely manifest itself in the kinetic warfare world. The whole point of why the Chinese are spending so much time trying to steal stuff and everyone else is one of the things they can do is they can make their weapons research and development go so much faster if they steal stuff and use it to what they're doing. I mean, the Soviets did this early in their weapons development history. When you would see fighter aircraft, you know, mysteriously have the same characteristics of what, you know, our weapon systems had. And then eventually it got to the point where, you know, I'm sure they were still stealing our weapons technology, but they developed their own industrial base to the point where they were developing really great weapons systems and unique weapons systems on their own. So this is my concern with the Chinese, that they're following this same information arc where it's like, okay, you know, why spend all the time doing research and development when we can steal stuff from, you know, the Western civilization, the advanced stuff they're doing? And the Chinese, if you have just a basic understanding of history, these are, you know, they've got just an amazing history of innovation and development and weapons technology. So I'm sure we will see their fighter weapons technology, their tanks and everything else become as good as ours, if not better, if we keep on this path. So that's my contribution. Thank you very much.
He's not going to go back in his box.
I'll go back in the box.
I think we need to wake up our listeners again. I think everyone. I think we lost everyone. Everyone fell asleep in the past like 10 minutes of discussion. This is one of those topics. We can, you know, at least I could sit around and be having at least 2-3 beers, and it's around beer number 3 that it becomes really interesting. Usually, usually a dark ale it will really make that happen.
No, and I knew this was going to be a good discussion when Ryan was on, because I don't know if you and Rob, I don't know if you and Ryan have actually met before, but you occupy the same space, so I figured you both have thought.
Like two electrons?
Sure. Yeah. I need to open up a beer.
I'm not sure if that's physically possible, but sure.
Quantum physics? Where are you right now? What are you looking at right now?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the air.
Oh, no. all right. Well, moving on. along a similar vein, Dark Reading reported a couple of weeks ago that cyber theft has now surpassed incidents of physical theft for the first time. So, I mean, this is quite incredible to me. Well, I think that it doesn't surprise a lot of people who are involved in computers on a daily basis, but if you're not involved with computing and you think about just like the physical act of stealing something, how on earth has this got
organized,
so high?
Organized crime has embraced this technology. So the old, you know, some of the people who have the worst threat pictures in the world are the banks. You know, think of the large, you know, global banks, you know, the few that are remaining standing. You have to put up with, I assume, the intelligence threat, you know, the nation state actors, because there's a lot of great financial intelligence there to go after. And then you're the bank, you know, you're where the money's at. So you've had these organized crime gangs that are really sophisticated. You know, there was a picture not that long ago of somebody, I was like, oh, a cartoon or something like that I saw, where, you know, it used to be back in the 80s, the idea of your cyber criminal was, you know, some 18-year-old hacker sitting in Germany. Now it's some guy, you know, working with Russian organized crime, for example, who's working on very advanced malware for financial purposes. So if there's an incredible amount of innovation, an incredible amount of money that have been put into this sort of crime via, you know, the organized criminal. So it doesn't surprise me that the, you know, physical theft, I mean, you walk into a bank here in the U.S., you pull out a gun, maybe you get a couple $1,000, maybe $10,000, depending on the day. The FBI is going to finish you off. I mean, you get all sorts of attention and you get thrown to jail for 10 years. It's the high risk versus low reward. It's not very well repeatable process, but man, you do it, you know, organized through some sort of cyber methodology, and you can make a lot of money, and it's very hard to trace you.
You know, I think part of the problem, too, is, I mean, to that point, you know, we talk about all these email scams and things like that that can, you know, virtually just fire and forget. You send out 1 million of these things.
Oh, yeah.
If you only get 100 responses.
It's still worth it.
Out of 1 million, that's less than 1%. But 100 responses, you could earn $6-7 million that you could take these 100 people for. I mean, every single person that sits in front of a computer has a target, a bullseye painted right on their forehead, and the criminals know it, because you're exactly right that these guys have the time, the resources, and certainly the financial motivation to keep doing what they're doing.
Just please tell them to bring enough paint. I have a really large head.
You know, I've heard that about you, Rob.
It's rather sizable. Very big pillow. I killed the conversation. Awesome.
That's it. No, I mean, the bottom line, Eric, you're exactly right. I mean, it's just way too easy. And as long as it stays that easy, which I think it will for the foreseeable future, because I don't think anybody has any idea at this point how to go about really curbing this growth in an effective way. It's just going to keep spiraling out of control until it becomes just really even more epidemic than it is now.
Yeah, it doesn't take that much. I mean, like, you know, phishing attack, just stealing. I mean, you can do things like these mass bits of malware trying to either harvest, you know, credentials just to get on people's accounts and steal it. There's all the money mule stuff, which, you know, I have to admit, I'm still amazed at the amount of people who fall for the 419 scams. And it's like, oh, gee, because, you know, I still see people reporting this. And, you know, it's like, really, you wired the money to, and some, you know, sometimes what they do is they wire the money to some places like here in the U.S., which, okay, it's still dumb, but there are some of these I've seen where it's like, you know, I wired the money to the Ukraine. I'm like, oh man, could it be any more obvious? And you fell for it. So it doesn't take that much. I mean, I always thought, and we've all read these 419 scams, and they're, you know, the they're not written all that well. And I've always thought, man, I wonder how much I could make, like, writing really good initial 419 scams email for, like, the scammers. If I ever went to the dark side, that's what I would do. I would contract myself out. It's like, look, guys, you know, don't start an email conversation that says, pleasant day. All right, most people are going to figure that out. All right, it's very West African. Don't do that. It's like, I'll write you up this the greatest 419 email ever, and you'll double your But, no, it's I'm amazed. So I don't know what you do about it other than
I'm gonna be the naysayer here. I don't believe in this report. And I was, you know, I've looked at this, you know, I've tried to wrap my head around it. And part of me feels that, you know, while there's probably some validity in some of the statistics that they're pulling out here, this is, I think, one of those fear things that, you know, they're trying to get, you know, constantly ever since the late 90s, in which they've, you know, you've had the fear propagators. This is, I feel, a little bit of fear propagation here. I don't truly believe that there's that, you know, there's groups out there that are doing this, but not to the scale that we're going to probably see in the future. This is not overtaken, like, you know, people getting mugged or, you know, common petty theft. You know, some things that we're currently seeing that's out there, maybe in the scale of the total amounts of money. Yes. But in terms of I think that's one of the things that they're trying to say. This is a total amount of money that's been taken. But again, from a criminal perspective and the way this story kind of sounds, it sounds like this is now a bigger problem than the older thefts that used to be. And if that's the case, it's probably true. But
I think the dollar amounts are more.
The dollar amounts, yeah. But again, there's a little bit of fear propagation. It's like, you know, if you take a look where it's from, Kroll Annual Global Fraud Report, granted, and I have a lot of people saying, well, didn't Mandiant also do something very similar to that this year with MTrends? Yes, but we were basically trying to come out. Here's exactly what we're seeing. Take it away what you will. You know, and here's our definition of it. But we're basically not saying overall that, you know, we're at cyber war and China's, you know, the people doing this. This ends up being a, you know, a really interesting, we got to still hold ourselves in check here before we move too far and saying, what is the statistics that totally generating this report? And is it being echoed by governments around the world for what they're seeing as well?
See, but it's difficult to focus on something other than the bottom line, because when we're talking about fraud and this type of cyber theft, about the easiest thing to translate it into is dollars and cents. So if you can't compare certainly the amount of money lost in either one, which is the practical effect of the crime, apples to apples, it starts to tell a completely distorted picture the other way by trying to compare number of street muggings to right. number of hacking incidents that resulted in loss. I mean, it's
What ends up coming out of this report is, you know, like, you know, you or I will receive a call from like the Orlando Weekly, and you know what they're going to ask you? They're going to say, "So should Grandma not do buy anything online, or should she not do anything with online baking?" And the response to that is generally the same, you know, that at least I have, is like, you know, during the 50s, we left our doors open. Now you don't. What happened? What changed? Our trust level changed, you know, but it's our threat still basically remained the same. And the, what people were doing were a little bit different as well. But it comes down to, does this change anything to the common person, or does this change, you know, is it like education? Are we not putting enough money into this? Is this our fault, or is what's truly going on here?
Well, I mean, it's the whole, you know, 50% of car accidents occur within 1 mile of your home. Okay, well then never go within a mile of your home. I mean, is that the other side of that? I mean, I think.
Well, that's a very good point.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right that we have to do our part, folks like the four of us, to temper the general reaction to this type of thing. But also, I think there is some good in it, and at least from the general. The more general understanding that this is a significant problem, and it's becoming more and more significant, at least in terms of resources that it's costing our economies.
Well, let me ask you another question here. Is this, you know, basically between Lee, Eric, and, you know, Ryan, all three of you have a very interesting perspective on this. What is the root cause of this? Why, you know, we've spent millions of dollars in information security. From appliances, training, you know, all the way down to, we have the same thing. What is causing this? Why are they getting away with it? You know, how come we put up everything? We even have compliance measures in place now across all the governments that says you should be doing this as your basics. Why isn't that having any effect? Why is this still a growing problem?
To quote my friend Mark McKinnon, there is no patch for human stupidity.
Yeah, you know,
it's all a human problem then?
No, it's trust. Look, the reason why we have so much, I mean, the reason why theft is big in, you know, cyberspace now is because theft is a very human behavior. This is a normal thing. We always have thieves. We always will have thieves. So the thieves have adapted to technology, and now they have a technology multiplier that allows them to steal more. Not that long ago in my hometown of Des Moines, the local Catholic diocese got nicked for $600,000. Well, you know, back when I was a police officer in Des Moines, generally, if you wanted to try and get a lot of money, you'd walk into a bank. Now, you know, the same, well, I mean, not the same thieves, but thieves in general can do more electronically. Does this mean you shouldn't do electronic banking? Does this mean you shouldn't do buying stuff online? No, of course not. You don't want to take this and turn it into some big fear, uncertainty, and doubt thing to scare people.
But this is not exactly new. You know, why are we having such a hard time stopping this is what my point is. This has become an issue where
trust.
Corporations are truly, you know, like blown away the fact that they have an intrusion. What has failed? What's failed in information security? This is my basic question. Why are we failing in information security?
You know, I think for me, I'm always accused of having a bit of a doom and gloom attitude about this. But, you know, the fact is, very simply, because they're better than us. Because the guy that is able to sit in his living room with his computer that's paid by organized crime to the tune of millions and millions of dollars to focus on one specific thing, one specific exploit, one specific target, one specific payoff. Again, millions and millions of dollars to do nothing but get smart and get better than you at this one specific thing is always going to win. They're always going to win because we don't have the right resources. The number of different exploits, the number of different vulnerabilities that I have to deal with just on a daily basis, not to mention all the paper I have to push and all the other things that draw my attention, and I'm not getting paid millions and millions of dollars. I'm getting paid significantly less than that. So until that type of thing changes, which it never will, by the way, nothing is going to change.
I'm never going to get paid millions of dollars. I'm disappointed now.
No, my evil counterpart, just like Ryan said, my evil counterpart, wherever he sits, doesn't have the layers of bureaucracy he has to go through. He doesn't have to necessarily show a return on investment. He doesn't necessarily have the distractions. He's part of an organization or on his own where he has a very focused mission and he's very motivated because there's a financial aspect to it. And I don't know if the evil organization has board meetings or weekly meetings or all the other stuff that bogs people down. You don't know if my evil counterpart has to fight off, six vendors a week telling him that, they could sell him for $50,000.
The recruitment agents.
So, yeah, he doesn't have, I'm a little bitter about, evil Eric, because he doesn't have all the nonsense he has to put up with. So
I've started in the past, 3 weeks starting doing a presentation, just basically discussing why is information security failing. And I think part of that answer, by the way, is rooted back into more of a historical perspective, that when you take a look at information security, we've treated this like we're defending a building, that it's preventable. You put up high enough walls, you put enough guards in front, you check everyone who goes in and out. It's a physical issue. And in reality, this is not a physical issue. Cyberspace is not a physical domain that we're trying to protect. And as a result, we're almost, for no other great example, you could use the Maginot Line leading up to World War II, because back then, the defensive position was considered the dominant between the defensive offensive. But again, we were shown that was incorrect. With agile, overwhelming firepower, you'd be able to get around defensive positions fairly quickly. And we look back on that and says, how could they miss that leading up to World War II? The same thing is currently going on right now, in which we're really starting to take a look at where are the true holes in this. And Ryan, what you're dealing with on a daily basis is the fact that exploits will always exist. It's kind of like saying, we will always catch a cold. That is true. But are the things we could do to reduce the amount of colds that we get? I do believe that answer is yes. I also believe that we could do a much better job currently at detecting when an incident occurs. Right now, 80% is not cutting it. I tell the audiences I talk to about this, until we finally have reduced that down to less than 50% of the incidents are being told to us by an external source, meaning that most organizations are detecting it themselves, we will always fail at information security. So detection ends up being the biggest issue, whether it's human-based, we have some automated measure, or we're basically using people like Ryan and Eric and Lee to be able to be on the front lines and using whatever food that they have in order to do that detection. And it could be we just have to have, pay Ryan millions of dollars to do this, but The main point is our paradigms need to shift in, basing what the vendors have been telling us, that you have a defensible, castle, into you're defending a garden, which is you will have weeds that will pop up and you need to identify and eradicate those weeds as quick as possible. And you'll always have this problem.
We're still debating. This is an illustration of kind of where we're at. We're all still debating this, and we're having very good conversations about this. Meanwhile, the bad guys, I don't think there's a lot of debate on what they do. they've got their mission, and they're getting their job done. So that's part of the I think that's part of the issue.
Well, I even believe in that you could still educate users better. I think a lot of people have given up on that, but I do think that you could improve their level of thought and interaction with digital devices.
Absolutely.
There are things that you could do to educate them on things, like when you're in a city, don't let you walk down dark alleys. There are things that you probably should or should not do, so that, say, maybe I shouldn't click on this one more time. And when it says, should you elevate your privileges to, something that you didn't know you were going to be doing before, maybe that shouldn't be doing that. It only said it need to do one thing, things that would potentially say this should not happen to you. Look for these anomalies. That way they know. We need to educate street smarts into our users in our corporations. And as Lance Bitzner routinely says, we need the human sensor. The human sensors are most incidents I've ever been involved with. Either a human being self-detected it, or someone felt something like a security operations center guru felt a disturbance. Like there's something that's just not right here, and they will continue hammering at it until they finally figure it out, and they find, look at that intrusion. And they, that's the type of person that you want. Nothing, we can never replace this for an automated, or at least from my opinion, a completely automated solution that is going to be like the MCP and Tron that will automatically defend your network against any intrusion.
Forensicator Pro.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, it's an evolution. It's a process. I mean, it still blows me away that, I mean, I'm still relatively young, but it blows me away. I do have kids to think that my sons will never grow up in a world where they don't remember having a computer.
Or
Harry Potter, for that matter. or playing their Harry Potter Lego game on the computer. It's a process. You know, it's one of those things as the old guard changes and the new generation grows up. I think that's something that will become a reality, whether that translates into better cybersecurity or simply more effective cyber criminals. I don't know.
I've picked up on some discussion recently where the thought process goes, okay, since signature-based detection, whether it be host-based or network-based, is a bad, you know, it really isn't keeping up the threats. Therefore, you know, it's crap. And there's this idea that says user education, antivirus patching, that was the old way of doing things. And gosh, that hasn't worked. So we have to come up with new ideas. And I agree with that. We do have to come up with new ideas. But you still have to do that old stuff. You still have to do user education. You still have to do, you know, your antivirus and your signature-based stuff. Even though it's not going to pick up a lot of the stuff, it will pick up some of the stuff and patching. So you got to still get the basic stuff right if you expect the advanced stuff to work. And user education is still the key. Or, maybe it's not the key, but it's still a really important aspect in what people do. So I'd hate to see that de-emphasized. Because, you know, it's not working the way we had hoped, but we just have to get better at it.
I have a different question. Rob, do you think that the average user, and in this I include some of the corporations and enterprise as well, do you think that they are more willing to listen to things like that from a company like yours, like Mandiant, or from the U.S. government?
Oh, geez. I don't think it matters either which way where it goes. I actually think it should be taught internally. Because nothing comes more important than a company basically saying, here's the way our network's laid out. Here's what you should see. Here's what you shouldn't see. And no one could do that better than a company that knows its own network or what should be flowing through it. And I think it's hand in hand. Potentially, those companies may need programs brought in to help them out get it to that point. Maybe some custom modules. So, you know, they have issues over other people's, you know, that they drop. Okay, well, we use X. You know, everyone uses some sort of databasing. We have a lot of people in the field. We have a lot of storefronts. I mean, every single corporation is going to be a little bit differently. So as a result, there's not going to be a single boilerplate you could use, but I think they could be developed independently for each corporation to say, here's what we think is nominal, and here's what you think should be, a level of alarm, suspicion, or things that you should know while working on your home systems. You could be exposed working in your home box by VPNing into our network and not really watching what you have in your own box's home. So I don't think it matters who's doing it. I definitely think it needs to be custom, though.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion recently, especially on Forensic Forecast, about how to get into the field and all that kind of stuff. We've talked about this quite frequently and talk about it over and over again. The one thing which has cropped up most recently is possibly, you know, universities and whatnot, people coming on to forums saying, what university should I attend? What course should I do? What paid courses should I go on, like SANS or Guidance or anything like that? I just wonder about what everyone's thoughts are on just the general education stance and the current situation in terms of digital forensics.
We've got quantity. I don't know that we have quality. I mean, there's when I first started in digital forensics, I think it was about, I don't think I've hit 10 years yet, but I got to be pretty close to it. I don't remember. I don't think there was much of anything available as far as formal training, academic training. And at the time, it was Guidance Software was doing a lot of, their one-week training classes. I think Access Data was really starting to spin up their training. And then you had, who I later found out, Rob was the guy behind it. You had, the big forensic class through SANS was oh, it was called Track 8, I think it was, back when I started. Now, there's a tremendous amount of vendor training. You know, Sands offers, you know, all sorts of different tracks, and full disclosure, I'm one of Rob's minions, Sands. I think most people know that. But, you know, Guidance and Access Data, they offer a lot of training. X-Ways, a lot of vendor training. You see the ISFCE, they have their one-week CCE boot camp. So there's a lot of really decent one-week training, and now there's a lot of academic programs, and most of them look like they're terrible. And I did a blog post on this not that long ago, and, you know, say you get a degree in computer forensics, and if you research the classes, it's like, man, you're there for 2 years, let's say, for an associate degree. Maybe they get one or two forensic classes, and if you look at the professor teaching it, there's no interest, there's no indication on this professor's CV that this person really has any interest in computer forensics. Now, there are some programs that are excellent. You know, Champlain is one I've highlighted because Gary Kessler spent a lot of time helping craft that, and he's excellent. And there's other programs too, Defiance. And I'm seeing, and Ryan, I think your program, I'd be curious about, I think you're more of a cybersecurity type program. Another thing I'm seeing at the same time is not only do you have some decent forensic programs coming up, now you're starting to see programs that are labeled sort of generically cybersecurity. For example, NYU Poly has got a really good program at the graduate level, and one of the classes they have is forensics. So I'm starting to see some programs that look very good. I don't know a lot about them that are basically not focusing on forensics. Forensics is a portion of what they do. But they have more of a general information warfare bent. So there are good programs out there, but there's a lot of bad ones, and they're turning a lot of, if you look on Forensic Focus, you know, some of these students, like, it was just this week, Lee, you were involved in a thread, I think you saw, where, you know, this guy's talking about going into his final year in a dissertation. He has no idea what to do, and no, doesn't seem to have any real interest in a specific topic, and you just wonder, what on earth were you doing all those time? And now I killed it. Yes!
Ta-da!
Just be Rob.
Yeah, Eric, you know, among some of the other programs you mentioned, University of Central Florida, I think is a pretty good program. I've heard some good feedback from their students. Friend of mine, Dan Purcell, is real involved in that program out of Florida. The one that you mentioned at University of Maryland, University College, they just started up their graduate program in cybersecurity to complement an undergrad program as well. The focus there is more on cybersecurity. I think the idea there was to kind of capture that lightning in a bottle, you know, particularly in this area around the Beltway. There's a shifting focus with the standup of U.S. Cybercom and some of these others, that cybersecurity is finally kind of a real big deal. And so the academic institutions are finally gravitating towards a little more focus into that area, away from the general IT, maybe network security perspective, and into something that's a little more, if not offensive computing focused, something that's a bit more focused on the actual defense from the bad guy, as opposed to just kind of general network setup. Now, the one of the things with this particular cybersecurity program that you mentioned with a lot of other schools is the focus on computer forensics is not huge. There are a couple of classes. There is a computer forensics class that they actually just did a big redesign on. I had a real big part in that, trying to keep it focused on computer forensics from the practitioner level, some really good scenarios, using some tools, some great texts. But that is kind of the focus of one class and the rollover of maybe another one. And after that, the cybersecurity stuff is a bit more focused on the general IT that we talk about that you see at a lot of other schools. So I don't want to mislead people to think that it's necessarily a computer forensics degree, but it is something that is cybersecurity focused, and it does have that computer forensics flavor to give people an idea if maybe they want to specialize in that particular specialty. But I think the best thing about this trend is that
it's really starting to get recognition. And the problem is, because it's so young, we're starting to, as you mentioned, get the bad with the good. But I think eventually the good, reputable, dependable programs that are turning out great practitioners and great people for our field are going to receive the recognition that they deserve and are going to start being the ones to regularly put the folks into our field that we want so welcome to the table.
This Rob? The education is kind of, obviously, I've been doing this for 10 years now, and I have several thoughts as to, what are the challenges right now? And for someone just entering, I have a lot of people, come up to me and say, "Hey, Rob, I'm just entering the field. What should I do?" And I never turn to them and say, "Hey, you need to come to a training course or you need to go to a university and get this." And I initially start them down the path. They say, "Nothing will ever replace the ability to self-educate yourself. You need to go out and buy books." I said, "The majority of stuff actually can be learned online, and you need to take it upon you to, basically learn how to train yourself into this field." And as a result, I also pointed to some of the cyber challenges, the U.S. Cyber Challenge, we now have digital forensics components of that. And I said, take a shot at these. I said, as you're progressing along here, you'll get to a point where you'll say, okay, I need to formalize this a little bit. I need to potentially take a look at university programs, formal training programs. I said, they don't come cheap, but there's always ways to potentially get through them at a cheaper cost, whether through volunteering, whether, you go to a CIC conference. There are a lot of different avenues out there. But the problem, the challenge when it comes to digital forensics, it's almost the same thing that happens when you look at the medical profession. It says everyone's going to be a doctor. Everyone's going to do forensics. The real challenge of that is it's not truly focused as well as it should be. There are many different flavors of digital forensics that are out there, from litigation support to the intelligence community. And both of those communities have do completely different results of why they do digital forensics, from information security to law enforcement. While they're similar, while they potentially have some of the similar moves, and you may still have to do an incision, the overall goal, necessity, outcome statements end up being much different of why you're doing it. From a single host into an enterprise, how are you potentially doing an enterprise level examination versus how are you doing a single host? These are questions that I think that, overall the university programs need to start focusing in on and say, what color are you really? It's a famous book that's out there, What Color is Your Parachute? Is that as our field grows, you just cannot slap the label digital forensics on it and get away with that. You need to be a little bit more specific on what flavor are you. If you're law enforcement, should I go to a program that teaches how to investigate systems that have intrusions? Well, perhaps, maybe if you're the FBI cyber squad, that might be very useful to you. But what about someone who's doing a traditional level computer forensics? Is that going to be as useful for them in order to how to find rootkits on a machine? Or maybe that's more of an advanced topic. The overall point is, we need to start labeling our programs a little bit better, becoming a little bit clearer on what type of forensics that we're doing, and not let, from a university perspective, you can't just label something digital forensics, add a single course, take everything that is forensics related, put it into some sort of track, and say, well, that's officially a program. The people who graduate those will be sorely disappointed to know that they're not as employable, because we truly do need people that are able to go through a system and understand how to go through event logs, that they're able to understand how to do memory analysis, that they're able to how to do unallocated space searches. These are types of prereqs, and if they're not familiar with that, regardless of the tools, then you essentially fail. And it's tough, but it all comes down to, even if you don't know how to do that, could you always teach it to yourself? The answer to that question should always be yes. But like everyone else, I personally like to sit in a classroom for 5 or 6, 7 days to learn it, if it's out there, if the people are good who are teaching it. But in a lot of cases, the stuff might not exist. I guarantee Lee, Eric, and Ryan, I would say, in reality, if you ask yourselves the question, what percentage of training have you done on your own versus been formally taught to you? And I think the answer to that question is, it should be fairly surprising here. At least for me, mine has been about definitely over 70-75% of what I've ever learned has been through studying on my own.
For me, probably 65-35 in favor of self-learning.
Yeah,
it's about the same for me. I learn a lot from one of the things I learn a lot from is like the various email lists I'm on, HTCC and CFID and all that. Somebody will have an email about something interesting. I'll run off and research something because it sparks an idea. just learn something for that. Somebody releases a new tool. Oh, hey, here's a new artifact. You know, get out the hex editor, look at things. So, yeah, that's a lot of how I learned, especially early in my career when I didn't have access to a lot of training. It was a lot of self-education.
I think certainly being plugged into the community is perhaps the fastest way to learn about new things which happen. But, I mean, I personally, the only training courses I've ever really been on have been guidance training courses. So my percentage of learning something useful from someone else compared to what I learned myself is probably about 5.95. I'm just poking at guidance. No, but seriously, it's
Dave Kovar is really upset right now. You're getting tweets from him now.
But certainly being plugged into the community and the discussions which people have on the mailing list, on Twitter, and you know, on Forensic Focus, that they're all invaluable. And I don't think there's a faster way to learn something, because I mean, look at the Sans Forensic blog is a perfect example of this, where something will happen, like there'll be a story in the news about, you know, an attack or something like that, and you can guarantee within a couple of days somebody's written something about that in a blog post, and you'll learn all, you know, the ins and outs of the type of thing which happened, and that's it. You start there and you start to learn. But I mean, how do you turn that into something formal that you're going to pass on to the rising generation?
Well, I mean, you're always going to be a little bit behind. I mean, that's kind of the bottom line is, you know, academia sees a trend, they see a need, they set out to fill it. That takes time, and by the time you get there, it's always just a touch stale. But the trick is to try to keep things contemporary and cutting edge enough that they still have relevance to the real world. Using again UMUC as an example, I hate to keep bringing that up and sound like a homer, but it's the one I have the most experience with. You know, they came to us for the course redesign, and because I'm just do that as kind of a side gig. I enjoy teaching, and you know, my primary job is working in the field, and their question was, you know, when we do this course redesign, here is the big question we want to answer. What do you, as a professional in the field, want these people to be able to do for you? What do you need them to know when they graduate to make a difference in your organization, to put them to work, to get them on a computer doing what it is they need to do, whether it be forensics or network defense or whatever it is you need them to do? How can we prepare them to do that? And I think that's a critical question that a lot of universities really need to ask in their course design, because I think Rob hit it right on the head when he said, you know, a lot of these universities are really missing the target with this, because they see this hot new trend and they're cobbling together some courses. And again, I'm using the general some universities. I'm not including like UCF or Champlain or these others that are doing a good job. But others that just see this hot new trend, they throw it together. They take a guy from the IT department and maybe a criminal justice professor, and they throw him on this and say, hey, make this work. And I think Rob said exactly right when he said that they're really doing these folks an injustice. And not only their graduates, but the folks that are hiring their graduates, expecting a particular level of product in the employee that they've just hired based on the strength and the recommendation of that degree in digital forensics.
That you see, computer science programs basically elevate a little bit better. Like the Carnegie Mellon's out there tend to have challenge a lot of their people in their programs to do, you know, research in areas that no one's ever seen before, theoretics, heuristics. And we potentially need to see that in digital forensics as well. But again, the only place you could do that right now is in the computer science side of that baton. I haven't seen a digital forensics program out there that is truly started to do that theoretical side. And everyone says, well, what is the true use of that? Well, you know, take, for example, what I believe the next iteration of digital forensics is, pattern recognition, the heuristics, being able to, you know, do facial recognition from any side. You know, say you put a picture in and you're looking for this pattern, this digit, the binary patterns, even though in a program, a JPEG, you know, can you find anything that somewhat matches that anywhere on this disc. You know, and I think Jesse's Jesse Kornbluh had a really good discussion at this point. You know, they could potentially find a 7-Eleven sign pretty easily, no matter what picture that it's in. But you know, we can't do that exactly with a face. There's so much out there that is yet to be discovered with how we're potentially going to be doing our jobs, that I think the university programs, that if they're going to take themselves seriously, need to potentially take a step forward and match what the computer science departments of a lot of these respectable universities are doing and start challenging their graduates to a much, much higher level of, you know, saying we need to bring out the research side to this and be able to give back via grants and other things back to the community, what we're basically, you're going to be studying here as a part of your program.
I think from the digital forensics perspective, on the academic side, I think it's still too new. We're still playing at the wrong level. I think to get the type of research and the push that you're talking about, our specialty as a field needs to be elevated to the focus of PhD and doctoral work to foster some of this groundbreaking research. We're one of the only fields, I think, that has PhD level digital forensics work done on a weekly basis and has been done for 5 or 10 years without any leading university actually offering a PhD in digital forensics.
Well, I think that's it. That's a very, very, very good point. And that's one of the reasons when people ask me, digital forensics degree or comp sci degree, which will do me better? I mean, I say comp sci. I say hands down, that's more applicable. It's going to lead you better places, and it's not going to potentially pigeonhole you definitely in digital forensics.
Yeah, I agree.
Even if you come out of that program with a comp sci degree, you will still probably be a better digital forensics practitioner in the end. And that's just where it is stands today. And I haven't looked at, you know, the CUCF programs or, you know, in-depth of the Champlain programs. But again, if someone's just generically saying comp sci or DF, I'm leaning right now to CS.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Or you get like a minor and, you know, do your comp sci, get some DF if you're really interested in doing that. There's no reason you can't.
Yeah, you can take the elective classes. Yeah,
Of course you can, absolutely. We're starting to see some research, and I'm not affiliated with NYU Poly, even though the second time I've mentioned them. I'm just, since I'm in the neighborhood, I'm familiar with them. They've done some research, for example, Dr. Nasir Mehmand's done work on their Adroit product, and that's research into the executive summary. It's just a better way of carving out JPEG images rather than just doing the old, you know, header method. They've put some effort into that. So I'm starting to see some of the academic digital forensics programs. In fact, that's not even a digital forensics program. That's a cybersecurity program. It's just Dr. Mehmand has an interest in digital forensics. I'm starting to see some research and development coming out of the universities that are being relevant, at least for, you know, us doing digital forensics on a tactical level. So I'm hoping that's the beginning of what Rob's talking about, what we need.
And what we're doing on the SANS front, which, by the way, you know, you're supposed to, we talked about this, the SANS quota, you said at least 3 or 4 times. I'm kidding. But in reality, SANS has a, obviously, we're becoming accredited, our degree program, and now we're having a forensics focus portion of that Master's in Information Security Engineering. But one of the things that we're leaning to, and one of the reasons I'm not just trying to say, hey, this is a great program. It is a great program. But part of the reason why I think it's good is that if you go through the courses that we have, you not only have to certify, but you have to go to reach gold status. Now, to reach gold status, you have to do a research paper. And it's usually something that's theoretical before. And it's actually one of the reasons through these gold papers that Super Timeline from Kristen was ever developed. He created that program as a result of submitting that as his gold paper of certification for SANS. And, you know, you got to hand it to Kristen for creating that. That's what I'm referring to. I said, while it's still nascent and potentially a lot of these other programs out there, you could still potentially say, hey, you know, do a research topic or anything you like that's a focused area for this. But at the same time, you know, try to contribute back. Try to figure out what you could say. What has no one taken a look at yet? Kristen chose, you know, I worked with him on this. He said, what would be a good topic? And we went back and forth, and we kind of outlined that tool as a result of our discussions. He said, okay, I have enough to go on. He goes into his, you know, closet, you know, and then 3 weeks later, out pops this code to Super Timeline. At that point, it was basically did 3 or 4 modules. but you could see where this was heading. And at that point, it just became a massive, wow, this is awesome effort. And he ends up getting a gold paper certification out of it. I think that's the kind of focus that I would like to see university programs head toward. You know, and not just one or two of them, but again, all of them potentially have that. Then we could potentially move forward as a profession to say, hey, there's new things that are constantly generating generated from these.
So, you know, things like that are absolutely brilliant. I think we absolutely cannot lose sight of the fact that knowledge without application is just useless. I mean, you can learn everything there is to know about digital forensics and computer science, but unless you turn that to a practical application that's going to do some good in the world or some good for your company or some good for yourself, it's really not going to amount to a hill of beans. So I think something like that project is brilliant. Keeping the focus on the practical application for the betterment of the field is going to win every time.
All right. Cool. That was fantastic. Thank you very much for that. I think I'm going to have to stop in a few minutes. But, Eric, I think this conversation about the future of forensic tools is going to have to wait for another time, unfortunately.
Oh, that's fine.
Will you say FTK 3 Imager, yay? Can we just leave it at that?
Yay!
Yay.
It's good.
Double yay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mount Image Pro is dead.
So especially since the memory acquisition now works on 64-bit systems as well. So,
that was
not as big of a cool factor, but trust me, that ends up becoming a very, very useful tool for people to use as via GUI, and it will not blue screen your system. So as a result, that's ends up being useful for a lot of law enforcement agencies out there. It just says here. Click here, and write the file name there, press return, and you're done.
Awesome. If you haven't downloaded it yet, go over to Access Data's website and download it from there, because it certainly is a step beyond anything which... Well, there's nothing really comparable out there at the moment now. It's no wonder it won a Forensic Forecast Award for Best Software.
I still have one thing that annoys me about it, though.
What's the one thing?
It's when you initially when it says I want to acquire logical image, it will only list Windows images that have an official drive letter. The only way you could acquire logical image of a non-Windows partition is you first have to add the evidence. Then you'll see your Mac partition, like on Bootcamp or your Linux boot side. Then you have to right-click on it, then acquire logical image. So it still doesn't give you the option at the front of it if you want to acquire logical image from anything that's non-Windows. And so I've sent that note to them, no response yet, but it's still kind of annoying that I have to take that extra three steps in order to acquire logical image from a Mac.
Wow, you're tough. Here I am, happy that we've got the best free tool possibly that's been produced
is,
in the last 5 years.
and you're picking
the sand out of your salad.
I know. But you know, again, I want something. If you're going to throw it out there as acquisition tool, I still say, hey, listen, this is extra two, three steps, and you know the code's already there. What is that fix really going to entail? So, that should be an easy fix. Should be.
Cool. Well, we promise.
But your point's well taken.
We promise that in the future, Eric's dying to talk about the future of forensic software and forensic tools. So we are going to have that conversation at some point. Sadly, it's just not going to be today. I just wanted to quickly the funny story. Well, it's not really funny, but just desserts. And I had to talk about it because the guy is called Wiener, and I don't get to say that word very often, and it's just funny. So a handyman has been jailed for planting porn on his boss's computer. It was a school caretaker called Neil Wiener, who planted evidence of indecent pictures of children on his boss's computer, then went in and reported him. And basically, this guy, his name's Eddie Thompson, his life was made a complete living hell for several years while this whole process went on. And finally, it was found that Wiener suitably named, might I add, eventually was jailed for 12 years for having set him up. So I just think the whole thing of setting people up is quite unusual. This is the first time I've seen a story quite like this. But I just wonder if anyone else has come across anything like this before or even heard about anything like this.
I haven't. I like the judges. I read the story this morning. I like the judges when he was talking in the sentencing. He told Wiener, "You'll go to prison for a very long time. The prison population is not renowned for being particularly fair or reasonable."
So can I ask which character you're going to dress up on the opening night at Harry Potter?
Oh, no. I've got a personal blog which I write on now and again, and one of them a couple of years ago was about all the people who line up for the Harry Potter books dressed in their Quidditch uniforms and Dementor suits and all that, and just about how sad it is. I just can't bring myself to do anything like that.
Have you seen the Conan O'Brien Triumph the Insult Comic
yes.
Dog. Okay, then we need Triumph to go to one of these lines. It's just for pure gratification.
You know, if it was a Twilight movie, I'm all for dressing up, but not for Harry Potter. No.
Oh, I can't believe you just said that. Oh, I want all my input stricken from this podcast. You just need to take it right out. I'm now officially embarrassed.
Bleep Ryan out of the entire thing. Bleep, bleep, bleep. That's it. We had Ryan Pippen on here, but it's like Jar Jar Binks. We'll just remove him from the film.
It's a bit of an in-joke because I've got a reputation now, thanks to Rob. About...
Hey, listen, that's not my fault. You brought it up at dinner.
You asked. Right. So.
You admit it.
Well, yeah. I read the books. All right. Thanks for everyone joining us this week. Thanks for Ryan. I hope we weren't too rough with you the first time on, and hopefully you'll come back again.
Oh, this was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problems at all. Thank you very much for joining us. And also, Rob, thanks for joining us again.
No problem. I enjoyed it. Thanks again. Please invite me back.
Yep, you're now tied with Mark McKinnon for your number of appearances. So I'll have to get you back another time for sure. And Rob can be found, the award-winning Rob Lee, of course, now, twice.
It sounds breaking up on you. I think the podcast is now having technical difficulties.
So, you can be found on the Sans blog and at Mandiant. And Eric Huber, as always, has been joining us again today. And Eric can be found at ericjhuber.com, his blog, A Fistful of Dongles.
Absolutely.
And And that's about it, really. Thanks for joining us again. And hopefully we can put out more regular episodes. We're thinking probably about once a month. And we'll go from there. But thanks again, and take care. Bye for now.